This is Bob Gilgore interviewing Ed Caldwell at 107 Caldwell Street on May 30th, 2000. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning.
I want to go back and revisit two things that you said to me. One of them was that when you were stopped by the police and handcuffed as a young man for a traffic violation, that you knew that you'd get beaten with a rubber hose. And yesterday, after we turned the tape off, you said something to me about distrust, the African-American distrust of the police. And I wonder if you would discuss that. Tell me what your feelings are about that.
Well, throughout history, you know, the African-American has really had a mistrust of the police, mainly because the police have abused. And this is something that your parents warned you against. This is things that you knew about. I've known several cases where the police took someone in and they beat them. Rubber hose didn't leave the kind of bruise marks and so forth. So you know, you knew that if you got carried in, that this was something that was going to happen. One of the things that you begin to look traditionally as the kind of persons that the police used to hire. I think it's a stereotype of smoking the bandit that the police used to hire, especially in Chapel Hill, Cobber, mainly in Cobber, with persons off the farm, not very much education. And this gave them a sense of power. Since that time, after the back in the 60s where we had the integration, the police made a better effort of who they were recruiting. They did a much better job of giving the police training. And so as you begin to look at Chapel Hill began to have a very good police department. And that was mainly because the criticisms they got during the civil rights movement, and the fact that the police had to interface with students. But if you knew that if you went in other communities, you just didn't challenge the police. You know, you had to be very subservient. You know, whatever they said, you said yes, sir, whatever. Mainly so that you could get away. But that was just sort of a known fact. Now, you did every once in a while run into a good policeman, you know, but you cringed the fact that you were stopped by the police. I was stopped as a, just before retirement, I was a 60-some-year-old man, and I was stopped by the police in Raleigh. I knew the way he put his hat on and he strutted up to the car, that I was in trouble. Okay, I didn't think that he was going to beat me, but I knew that he was going to give me a ticket. I didn't really know whether or not to get out of the car, sit in the car. My thing was to get out the car to show that I didn't have anything in my hand, because I didn't want to really be shot by police, because there have been cases of Afro-Americans shooting police, mainly out of fear or out of stupidity or whatever. But the Afro-Americans really fear the police. So I got out the car, you know, to show that I had nothing in my hand, you know, and he very discourteous said, get back in the car, you know. I don't know if he called me a boy, but I really felt no respect and whatever. I immediately went out and talked to the people at the Raleigh Police Department, but they pretty much went along with their policemen. It's sort of a, I don't know, they stick together. And this was a black a sergeant that I talked to, but he took the position of defending his patrolman. I had planned to go back to court. I just felt that I needed to go back, and it slipped my mind because I was working and that sort of thing. But we were always warned from your parents, never, ever, you know, challenge the police. Let me give you an incident that when I was 12, Dinwiddie, Virginia was a speed trap. Okay. If you were going through and you were Afro-American or you were anybody, you know, they pulled you. That's the way they made their money, you know, for the city. Well, as a 12-year-old boy, we were poor. We were moving my uncle back to Chapel Hill. Well, my uncle filled a car full of his prized alcohol. And during those days, you weren't supposed to carry but so many quarts across the border. you were considered bootlegging. And at that time, that was rationing. And the cops stopped us because, you know, we were sitting too high up in the in the back seat, me and my cousin. And, you know, so he asked us to get out, and he went through and he found the alcohol. He was really looking for gasoline. And they took us to jail in Dinwiddie. They confiscated the car. They put my uncle in jail, and they were getting ready to put me, my cousin, and my father in jail. Well, my father had the right of one telephone call. So he said, I want to make my telephone call. Well, he called the Secretary of the Army, who was, his name was Kenneth Royal, as I mentioned to you before. Well, the judge, let me explain a little bit more, that the person that pulled you over also changed hats and he became the judge. You know, and he tried you right there. And well, my father called the Secretary of the Army. It so happened that he was in. And he came on. He said, I have a collect call from Edwin Caldwell, you know. He said, you know, through his secretary. The secretary said, I'll take it. And so he said, Eddie, what's wrong? You know, and my father explained to him that we were in jail at Dinwiddie. And so he said, put the guy on the phone. And it so happened that the judge and Secretary Royal were friends. They had gone to school at the University of North Carolina in law school and whatever. And they start talking. They immediately, you know, were told to put us on a bus, and me and my cousin and my father were put on the bus, and we traveled back to Chapel Hill. They kept my uncle in jail, I guess, as collateral. I don't know why they kept him. But my father went back, and he had to buy his car back at auction, you know. So he tells that story, and I have a tape, you know, and that's a true story. And they just couldn't believe that here's this black man that would know the Secretary of the Army. But I've been stopped in Virginia and other places. And I was always very subservient. You just don't challenge the police. One of the things now, with so many Hispanics coming in, they don't understand the language, you know, and the police give these orders and they don't understand. And what they're finding out now is that they're going to have interpreters, because I would imagine Hispanics must also fear the police, being whether or not they have their green cards or whatever. So they panic and whatever. I heard that on the news. So I would imagine Hispanics and blacks also feel pretty much the same way. That's pretty much it.
I wanted to get into one other area that you mentioned yesterday, but make it part of another question. And, what I'd like you to do is tell me about the jobs that you've had and ethnic interactions and how you have seen that change over the years. But you had mentioned how the black man needs to act yesterday, and somewhere in there, if you would cover that as well, I'd appreciate it.
I know it's been my case. You really can't come across as being too smart and bright. It's very threatening to whoever you may work for. That happened, I guess, when I went to chemistry. I had a supervisor that was a Duke graduate. He really felt himself. I had been doing most of the work, so that I became very familiar with what we were doing and that sort of thing as far as the research. And on a couple occasions, you know, I got my voice right and whatever, and I just said, why are we doing this? Why don't we do it this way? You know, immediately bristled, said, I'm the supervisor, you know. I graduated from Duke, you know, you do what I say. And, you know, and I realized there that you just didn't challenge, you know, what he was saying. Others, you know, began to understand that I had a good grasp of the knowledge and whatever. When he left, I got put in charge of the research project because I had more knowledge than anybody else. Chemistry and Jelly didn't put a BS chemist in charge of no research project. You know, for status of the company, you always had a certain number of PhDs, and only a few persons that had BS degrees were given research projects. Bill Blackburn is one that you know. Bill Blackburn was a very smart person and knew what he was doing. He got to run a project. They put me in charge of a high temperature fiber project because nobody else knew anything about it. And when my supervisor left, we were scaling up from the research in the lab to see whether the application was practical. And so we scaled it up, you know, for the plants. I got put in charge of that, okay? I did a little botany, okay? I told them that there were cases where people were put in charge of projects and I wanted to have the opportunity, and they did, okay? I got to run that project. I got to write it up. I was weak in my writing skills. They said that they would promote me if I could demonstrate that I could write technical research papers and so forth. I could do the work and whatever, but I was weak there. So I went to Bonnet, and also the same thing. I worked for a man named Bob Cottingham, and I mentioned him briefly yesterday when he asked me question decision that I made on the school board. Okay, and we had a very good working relationship, and that's the only time that he had questioned me. Bob Cottingham taught me a lot. I mean, just absolutely everything that he did, he taught me. I learned how to make blow glass and make apparatus. I just learned a lot, and he trusted me. Now, when I went out to the plant, okay, plants were in Tennessee, right? And here they sending this person out, man, to troubleshoot in the plant to find out why we were making nylon. The raw materials were good. You know, we tested them in the lab, and we got very good nylon in the lab. And they sent me out there to find out, well, what was happening at the plant. Well, I found out that I had a difficult time trying to tell them what they were doing wrong. Okay, what they did was they hired people with less than college educations to run those plants and make that nylon, and they just did not adhere to specific conditions and so forth. They just sort of made it, and so the nylon was coming out inferior. And when I tried to say you got to maintain the temperature and vacuum and whatever, these got to be adhered to, or you're going to get a bad product. They almost had to get me out of there because they wouldn't listen to me, you know. I mean, they walked off the job, man, you know. So even though I had skills, they would prefer to have a bad product than have a black man tell them what to do. And I went out several times to the plants to supervise and find out why we weren't making a good product. When Cottingham left, they put me with some other professionals. And I felt very good about what I could do. And I just had, I just seemed to rub people the wrong way. I knew what I knew, and they knew that I had worked for Bob Cottingham, and nobody liked him because he's a very bright man. So they sort of took that out on me. When I went to work for the state, I also had problems with Orange Chatham Comprehensive Health when I worked there. That happened to be a black man. His name was Paul Austin. He was paranoid, and I had a lot of skills and so forth, and he was also paranoid of my abilities and so forth. And I had to put up with that for 5 years, and I just said, I can't put up with it anymore. And so I went to work for the state. Howard Lee asked me to come over and interview for a directorship of the Appalachian Housing Program. I knew that I had the experience, you know, whatever, and I was suited for that particular job. I knew grant writing. I knew everything was to be known. I went over for the interview, and it was a joke. You know, they just went through the motions, you know, with no idea of hiring me. And I went back to Howard, and I said, man, why you waste my time sending me over here? These people are not going to hire me. You know, I could tell the way that the interview went. And he didn't ask me no questions to find out my abilities and whatever. So Howard hired me from as secretary of the department and put me there, which was, they didn't know I was coming. He told me to report to work. I reported to work, and they were shocked, okay? They made it tough on me.
Were you the only black man there?
At that time, yeah, I was. But the lady that was operating the program was gonna leave. She was in Winston-Salem. The program was in Winston-Salem. My job was to go and train with the lady that was leaving the program, that I was gonna take those place, bring and move the office back to Raleigh. Okay. Before I talk about the lady and and went to Salem. I didn't have a desk, I didn't have an office, I was working out of shoeboxes. They didn't make any effort to find me any place to sit. So I sit in the director's office of the program, of the housing, you know. That was a little awkward, you know, because he was making telephone calls and I was getting up every 5 minutes because I didn't want to listen to his telephone call. And so as I began to learn my way around, I went and found my own self office. And moved into it. Okay. Let me talk a little bit about when I went to Winston-Salem, nobody informed the lady that I was coming to be trained. Okay. And she was peeved. Which, you know, here somebody is being sent to Winston-Salem and she didn't know anything about it. She didn't know I was hired. I sat there for 3 days. She didn't talk to me. She let me sit there, okay? She didn't train me or whatever. And here I'm sitting here, man, and, you know, I said, well, you know, am I being set up to fail or what? So I wrote a memo. I'm sitting there in that room where she is. We ain't talking. I wrote a memo and got somebody to type it up. And told her that she had started this program. She had a responsibility to train me and let the program go down the tube. Okay. And I expected a lot more out of her because I had heard a lot about her skills and whatever. And in the next 2 days, I expected her to train me. Okay. And I put that memo on her desk. And she came and she apologized. She said that she was angry. It wasn't at me. It was at the way it was held. And she did the best she could, man, to train me in 2 days. That you can't train nobody in 2 days, okay? And what she said was, I'm wrong. I will continue to help you even after I go off the payroll, you know. I would put it a real disadvantage. It took me a while to really go through and learn how that program worked. Here I was supposed to be dispensing federal grants and whatever, and I really didn't know what I was doing. So nobody else knew but this one person. Okay. So I went and got me a plane ticket, and I went to Washington. I made the people at the Appalachian Region Commission office in Washington train me, okay? Which then ran me again and in with my boss. Because he said, well, who gave you the right to go to Washington? I said, I gave myself the right to go to Washington. I thought I was an independent person that's supposed to operate this program. This program just happens to be in your department, in your division. But the responsibility is with the governor's office as well as Washington. I'm not going to fail. Y'all not going to set me up to fail. Okay? I'm going to learn what I'm supposed to do. And so that's what happened. People in Washington assigned people in the governor's office to work with me personally so that I didn't mess up no grants. Okay? After that, they began to I guess get used to me and whatever. They sort of accepted me into the division, you know, but I had a tough time. My whole working in state government was very, very tough. I didn't get a lot of help. Howard took me out of the position of ARC just as I was getting comfortable of how you operate that program, made me assistant director of housing. You know, they had two housing programs, and at some point they were going to merge the two programs. They wanted to merge the division of housing in with the housing finance agency and make it one agency, make it a stronger agency. therefore I became the assistant director, whatever. The housing finance agency had a board of directors, and they didn't want to combine the division of housing in there. So here I am running up against the board of directors that didn't want, you know, the housing. As I mentioned yesterday about becoming the interim director, I won't go back over that story. I would take up from at the point that they hired a new director. As I mentioned yesterday, the new director came in and he wanted me to resign. Well, the board felt that I may have some trouble. They made me deputy director of the Housing Finance Agency. You want to cut that off? Let me hear that. So the board of directors made sure that I had done such a good job as interim director. I ran that program for a year until they found somebody. And when the new person came in, I met with him, okay, to try to convince him that he ought to take the job. He was the executive director out in, gracious, I can't even remember the state that he was in, but he was very bright, had good credentials and whatever, and very personable. They set it up for me to talk to him and interview him. I guess I came over too strong or something. As we talked, I talked about what I had done, what we were doing, and, you know, and so forth. And got a strange look in his face. He went back and told people that he didn't think that he want to come into this job. Okay, I was threatening. Okay, he asked me if I was gonna leave. I told him no, I wasn't planning on leaving. I've just been made deputy director. No, I wasn't going anywhere. So the board talked to him. They talked, convinced him that he ought to take the job. I had lunch with his wife and another person. And his wife had said that Bob would like to hire his own deputy. You think that you're going to stay? And I, you know, my heels sort of went up. You know, I didn't tell her that I was going to stay, but I wasn't going anywhere. You know, I worked hard to get that position. The board honored me for the work I had done to give me the position plus the raise. Okay, I make more money then than I've ever made, you know, so no, I wasn't going anywhere. That was real friction. And the moment he came, real friction. He was not going to let me tell him anything. The board had given me instructions to sit down with name is Bob, and go over where I was and have a smooth transition. Now, he didn't want that at all. He didn't even want to talk to me, you know. I still wasn't going anywhere, okay? And at some point, you know, I went in and we talked. I said, I don't plan to go nowhere. All my life, I worked very hard. They say hard work and so forth that you can move up. We gotta find a way to work together. Okay. And he agreed. He said, if you stay out these areas, you know, and you concentrate on these areas, I think that we'll work very well. What that meant was I had nothing to do with the programming. Okay. And I just ran the administration part of it. Personnel, hiring, recruiting, and whatever. And that worked. You know, I was a people person. And, you know, I like personnel. I liked administration. By that time, I was very well known around government. made a lot of friends. I'd get anything done. Right? That was threatening to him. He'd give me these projects. You know, this is what I want you to do. No problem, because I knew everybody in government and I could go get it done. And it amazed him that I was getting these things done. One time he told me that, well, the governor said that he wanted a strong affirmative action program. He was Republican and he was trying to recruit black into the Republican Party. And so they called on me, you know, to make sure that we had a strong affirmative action program. In fact, the Housing Finance Agency had the best affirmative action program in the state of all departments, okay? And I had a direct link into the governor's office.
Well, what did that mean, a good affirmative action?
Well, you know, we had objectives that based on the number of persons working, then we needed to recruit a certain number of women, a certain number of black, a certain number of Asian, a certain number of Hispanics, you know. And you had these goals. And not only did we reach these goals, we succeeded these goals. We needed to have good training programs. We need to look at the number of blacks in supervisory jobs, administrative jobs, and whatever. And our numbers were just superb. And he used my numbers as a model, you know, to talk to other departments and so forth. So I had a good relationship with the governor's office. And it made him look very good. My executive director came and said, we're not going to have an affirmative action program anymore. Well, you know, Bob, I didn't argue with him. I went to the governor's office, okay? And I told him that my affirmative action program is being disbanded. You know. So they called him in, okay? I didn't let him know I had anything to do with it. They called him in. They called him to the governor's office, okay? He didn't even know where the governor's office was. I had to tell him where to go and how to get there. And, you know, the lady told him, said, don't worry about it. We'll deal with him, okay? And when he came back, you know, I'm there just working away just like I didn't know. And they'd already called me and told me what they had said to him, okay? So I guess I was talking about him being called to the governor's office. And they laid it down to him. They said, we don't really need, what you need to do back is go back and work with Ed. He's the best person in government. So we would suggest, highly recommend that you go back. And you don't even get in it. You just let Ed run that program. And he came back and he said to me, he said, you're well thought of. I just left the governor's office and they think very highly of you. I said, really? But, you know, I'd already programmed that, you know. And so we were always running into problems. He didn't like me offering suggestions. It just made him very uncomfortable. I didn't get to make reports to the board of directors. They all knew who I was and whatever. It just pained him to make any kind of reference, you know, that I was doing a good job. We had a performance evaluation instrument. And I'd had to admit, the one he brought from, he was from Utah, was very, very good. You know, I really liked that. What I did was take the best parts of his evaluation instrument and add it to it. and made it stronger. One of the things was is that we set objectives, and at the end of 6 months, you looked at a person and you see how well they did on their objectives. I knew that he gave me very difficult objectives to accomplish, you know. Bob, I worked my tail off. I was not going to let him give me something, man, that I did not accomplish. Not only did I accomplish everything, I succeed, you know, what it was that he had given me. And he was fair. I mean, when he wrote it up, he gave me credit for what I've done. But they were quantifiable. I mean, he couldn't help but give me credit. You know, and everything that he gave me to do, not only did I accomplish him, you know, I had superior, okay? I went way beyond. I worked my tail off, okay? I didn't have a secretary. He didn't let me have a secretary, man. And he put me under hardships, okay? I learned to use a computer. Because they had a computer back on the shelf. And I told the people, put it on my desk. Okay. And I started typing all my own reports and all my memos and whatever. I mentioned to you that when I worked for Chemspan, writing was a difficult subject for me. Not only did I learn to write, because he was a very good writer. I mean, I give him credit. He was an excellent writer. And I learned these skills from him. You know, I just watched how he wrote. I think in school his subject matter was writing in English. You know, so he was good. But I worked to be just as good as he was. You know, he would critique my writing, you know. I got better. I was determined that I was going to be able to be a good writer, because he had written up that my writing needed improvement. And in the end, you know, my writing was very good. Okay. But I learned from him. Okay. I learned how to be brief, to the point, and whatever. I took a lot of time. I proofread, I edit, you know, I may write a memo 3 or 4 times, you know, until I got it where it said exactly what it needed to be said. So I learned a lot from it. But he pushed me, you know. He was also uncomfortable if I did anything where people complimented me. Okay. Somebody outside the agent complimented me on doing an excellent job, made him very uneasy, made him uncomfortable. Okay. Therefore, then he tried to make sure that I didn't go out, you know, into other departments and whatever. I never got a chance to travel to the meetings, you know. We had conventions and so forth. I never got to go to any conventions. Okay. Everybody that I had met as interim said, where's Ed? You know, we never see him at any meetings. I resigned myself to the fact, well, hell, I'm not going to get to go to the meetings. So I made little games and so forth. But I stopped asking to go, because I stopped. Hate to be turned down all the time. And so before they started to plan to go to a conference or a convention, you know, I always said, well, you know, I'll stay back here and run the agency while you're gone. Okay. I got to go to certain state things in state, but I never got to travel outside. Very noticeable by board members, of our staff, they knew that the working relationship was strained at most. At the point that when my father got sick, I was working on salary study. Okay, I was analyzing all the jobs. Number one, to see whether anybody, let's see how I'm gonna say this. There were some positions, mostly African-Americans, that had not been given raises. And so therefore, as I looked at comparable work, you know, for what they were doing, they weren't being paid, you know. So my salary study, not only major looked at women, looked at minorities, looked at people in general, to see whether or not they need to be brought up to their experience and their education and whatever. We had criteria which we used to determine whether or not these people should be brought up to a certain level. Pretty much I worked on that salary study by myself. I did hire me a consultant, you know, that had worked for the state and whatever. I pretty much told her what I wanted. I told her that I hired her because I could do it myself, but if it came from me, it would be suspect. If it came from a consultant, then they would buy into it. And she couldn't believe it, but that's the way it was. I worked on a number of proposals and so forth that the federal government demanded, you know, that we implement. One was drug enforcement proposal that the government said that anybody receiving federal government monies must adhere to these. So pretty much I always wrote these things up and passed them in. He didn't even know that they were being passed in, okay? Until they came back and people said, hey, this is good, you know? Which then also made him uncomfortable. If I had gone to him and he was gonna change it, well, he didn't know what he was looking at, okay? He'd never read the guidelines and so forth, and so I just bypassed him. Send it in. Okay. I did a lot of things, man, like that, where we had reports and so forth that came back from people in government and said that these things were very, very good. Still made him very uncomfortable. Okay, we need to be complimented.
What years are you talking about?
This is the 90s, just before I retired. This is 5 years before I retired. Okay. I knew at that time that I had to leave. Okay. Just too difficult for me to work under these kind of conditions where I had to hold myself back and never know if I did too much, whether it was going to be frowned upon, that sort of thing. But I also knew that I was not going to fail. I was gonna do my very best, okay? I made up my mind, I'm always do my very best. Whatever I turned in, you know, was gonna be good. And when I say turned in, the governor's office and other departments required us to turn things in. The federal government required us to put things in place and so forth. Drug-free workplace policies and things like that. And they were very good. Still, that was my area. We had agreed that, you know, I would do these things. I wrote a policy manual. Very good. You know, I'd written policy manuals, man, with the Chaplain School Board. I mean, making policy was what we did. Wrote a policy manual for the North Carolina School Board Association. wrote it for the Housing Finance Agency when I first went to work there before he came. So we had difficulties. He brought his policy manual from Utah. And it had a lot to be desired. Okay. State dictated, man, that you have certain policies in place. Okay. Every time Jones Sumner passed a statute, these things had to be written up and put in place. Okay. And he's saying to me, no, I don't think we need to put that in state law. Okay. I did it anyway. I mean, who am I going to listen to? General Assembly or him? Okay? So I did it anyway to take my consequences, you know. And when he found out they were in place, you know, we always had these frictions of telling me that I shouldn't do this or whatever. Okay? And I just gauged, man, what was law, what the federal government said you need to do. And that's what I did. I was not going to come up short. You know, somebody said, well, where is your drug-free workplace policy? You know, I'm going to have it, because it had to be done by a certain period of time.